Hello, it's Tuesday the 8th of June. I'm Louise Herity. This is Playback Daily and here's just some of what's coming up.
You know, many singletons put their love lives on hold during lockdown, but now that things are opening up, you know, they're really eager to find a soulmate, but they've been in lockdown so long, many are very anxious and they lack confidence.
I was totally surprised. The Pride of the Dacia Festival and the flying of the flags in Waterford was very warmly received by members of the public right throughout the city and county. So for this act to occur on Sunday night, it certainly came as a bolt out of the blue.
So I think one of the important things I want to do this morning was to kind of bring them up to speed with the latest information that we have from the research that shows that this vaccine is safe in pregnancy.
Finding love after lockdown, pregnancy, COVID and the vaccine and home renovations. That's all on the way over the next hour. But first, with the Leave Insert starting tomorrow, Damien O'Reilly, who was in for Claire Byrne, spoke to Minister for Education, Norma Foley.
Good morning, Damien.
Firstly, the class of 2021, this year's class, they've probably had more disruption than their predecessors last year because they've had 2 years of disruption, but they do have a choice of options for accredited results or sitting the exam. What's the breakdown on numbers? How many are actually going to be sitting the exam and how many have gone for accreditation?
Well, you're quite correct. This has been particularly challenging, I would say 18 months really, for the class of 2021. And I do at this point, Damien, want to pay tribute to their extraordinary resilience, determination and focus in actually getting to this point. I think they have been remarkable young people. Specifically in relation to the question as regards the accredited grades and the written exams breakdown, more than 99% of students have opted for the accredited grades process and in and around 91% have opted for one or more subjects within the written exams. And so to give that a bit of context, I suppose two-thirds or 40,000 or more students have opted to take five or more of the written subjects. So I think really results like that are testament to the very positive and good decision to give that opportunity to students to avail of the accredited grades. The written exams are indeed a combination of both, and it was something that the students themselves were very keen to receive, and indeed it was endorsed by the Partners in Education. So I think in the main it really has proved to be a very positive decision for them.
Okay, but for those students that have opted to sit the exam, that choice may be taken completely away from them, because the Irish Independent reports this morning that according to the State Examinations Commission, students with COVID symptoms won't be allowed to sit their exam. What is the situation there? We have 24 hours to go or a little less now. Students later on today that may not be feeling well, will they be allowed to go in and sit the exam?
No, the exam situation will operate very similar to how our schools have operated throughout these past number of months. If a student is feeling unwell, a student does not come to the exam centre. But equally so, I think it shows the foresight really of having the accredited grade system in place. It affords students the opportunity to realise if they're not feeling well, they don't take the written exams, but they do have the comfort and the security of the accredited grades process. And I think that in many respects mitigates the burden that might well be placed upon them.
But whose decision will it be to stop a student from sitting the exam tomorrow?
Well, to be fair, I think, as I say, school, in terms of the exams tomorrow and throughout the duration of the exams, will operate very similarly to school. If a student is not feeling well, the student does not come to school. If an incident does arise in school or whilst the exams are taking place, it will be a matter for public health. But students, to their credit, are very familiar with how the system has operated for this past year, indeed this past 18 months, I suppose, really now, in schools. They know what is expected of them. They're very well advised. There has been considerable engagement with students from the point of view, I suppose, of their teachers, their principals, board of management, and indeed the CMO directly engaging with students, advising them on how best to approach the exams.
But this is, as we know, the most stressful time for a lot of people sitting, obviously, the Leaving Cert, and we know that going back the years. What if you have a situation where a student mightn't be feeling well this evening, is showing all the symptoms maybe of COVID, but maybe somebody that's prone to hay fever and their parents are determined and they're determined to sit the exam tomorrow? Are we going to have a standoff in an exam hall or outside a school?
No, we haven't had that situation to date, and I have every confidence we won't have that situation tomorrow. And if a student is feeling unwell and their parents are aware that they're feeling unwell, the student themselves, they have recourse to their GP. And, you know, I think everyone is very conscious of the importance of leaving certificate time in the life of the student and indeed in the life of the family. I've always felt that when a student is taking leaving certificate, the whole family is taking it with them. So, you know, you consult with your doctor and you do as you have done throughout this past school year, and all will be well. And again, I will reiterate, there is comfort of the accredited grades process. And I think that's a very important assurance and reassurance to students at this point.
But another reassurance would have been a backup paper. Why do we not have a backup paper for a student that may be forced to self-isolate because they're a close contact or because they have symptoms?
Well, I think to be fair, Damien, you know, it is a remarkable achievement to, at this point, to be running two processes, if you like, to make available to students the accredited grades process and to make available the written exams. In fact, I'd have to say, to the best of my knowledge, we are unique in the world in offering that opportunity to students.
But should we have a backup paper like we would have in other years where students were forced to miss exams for various reasons?
But again, I think we must remember this is not an ordinary year. This is not a typical year. This is a year where we're offering two processes to students in the midst of a pandemic. And equally so, as I say, if a student is not in the position to avail of the written exams, they do have the opportunity to avail of the accredited grades process. And for example, I'd have to say, should we offer a third option of a written exam, there's every reason why should we not offer a fourth option of an exam should the need arise. So I think every possible contingency has been looked at. I think it's an extraordinary achievement of the State Examinations Commission to be in a position to offer both the accredited grades process and the written exam simultaneously, and I think students will benefit greatly from that.
But with respect, Minister, you probably wouldn't need a fourth, like the other option of a backup paper, just to get back to that question. Why was that not considered? Because I know it was raised with you in the Dáil by the Sinn Féin spokesperson on education, Donal O'Leary. O'Leary says he's raised it on many occasions with you. So why has that third option for students today who may discover they have been a close contact and are forced not to be able to sit their exams over the next 2 or 3 days or indeed the next 2 weeks in possible cases? Really studious students who really, really wanted to sit the exam, didn't want to fall back onto the accredited results. Why are they be denied an option of a backup paper?
And again, Damiel, I would say I would wish that we could operate the system as normally as possible for our students. I'm very conscious. I come from the teaching background myself. I know leaving certificate examination time is always a particularly challenging time for students. And in the midst of pandemic, we have done all that we can to make it as normal as possible. So we are offering the written exams and we are also offering the accredited grades process. The accredited grades process is an opportunity for students who, for whatever reason, might not be in a position to avail of the written exam, they can avail of the accredited grades process. I think that's very, very fair. I think that's very reasonable in the midst of a pandemic. We are not in ordinary times now. We are in extraordinary times, and there must be an acknowledgement of that. And again, I'll say, I think it's a fair achievement by the State Examinations Commission to be able to offer both processes to students.
Okay, we are in extraordinary times, and that's probably the reason, I suppose, why I go back to this question, which may seem pedantic in a way, but if a student is not feeling well this evening, but as I said, knows that they're prone maybe to hay fever and knows in their own mind that they do not have the symptoms, they have the symptoms, but they don't have actual COVID, is it up to them to prove that they don't have it? Or is it enough for their parents to go to school with them tomorrow and say, my son or my daughter is prone to hay fever, if they're sneezing or coughing, we can guarantee it's not COVID?
Well, I think the best situation there all around would be to take the advice of the GP. I think there is a heightened sensitivity now and people will appreciate that. And I think in the best interest of everyone and to calm all nerves and all concerns, I think we need to be especially vigilant. And if there's any question or any doubt, I would urge that you would take the advice of your GP.
OK, now the results are coming out on September 3rd. Again, there's been some criticism of that it's too late. Why September 3rd? Why not bring it back to August like it always has been pre last year?
Well, September the 3rd is the advice and the expert advice of the State Examinations Commission. The State Examinations Commission this year have oversight and responsibility for the running of the accredited grades process and, as always, the running of the written exams. And it is their expert view that this time is necessary for them to ensure that they can run, as I've said, two processes simultaneously. And again, acknowledging that this is an extraordinary, I suppose, responsibility placed on their shoulders and an extraordinary burden of responsibility in terms of delivering two processes simultaneously, again, as I say, almost unique in the world. And it is their view that they need that additional time to put the checks and balances in place, and they also, there is an additional layer of assurance as well in terms of quality assurance being employed as well. So it is their view that this time is needed, but I want to assure students that the results, as you say, will issue on the 3rd of September. The CEO, that's a Friday, the following Tuesday the CEO offers will be made, and on the following Wednesday, the 8th of September, it will be the UCAS deadline for acceptance of offers. So I think in that respect, timelines have been met, and they are timelines, again, I would say, that are in the midst of a pandemic. You know, it is not normal times, you know, when we would talk about a traditional time for Leaving Certificate results. And indeed, on that point, I suppose Leaving Cert is, again, that little bit later this year compared to traditional years. It has fallen that bit later on the 9th. It's generally maybe the 3rd, 4th, 5th, or whatever.
Okay. If you're not happy with your written results, can you appeal, or are you given your accredited results?
Oh, well, there's always an opportunity to appeal. You know, it will be the same for the written exams as it will be for the accredited grades. But on the day, what you will receive when you're getting your results, you will receive the best version of results, if you like. If in a particular subject you have done better via the accredited grades process, then you will receive the mark from the accredited grades, or vice versa. If you've achieved better in the written exams, you will receive that grade on the day. But there is obviously an appeal process, as always.
Right. And will that hold up? Students who are obviously looking to start college maybe 2 or 3 weeks after they get the results?
No, last year we were very successful in ensuring that the appeals took place within a time frame that was acceptable for those who were opting to take up particular courses at third level or further education or whatever career path students were hoping to follow. And I have every confidence we'll be within that timeline as well this year.
Well, just on the timeline, the TUI, as you know, has said that it has concerns that some students, particularly those looking at further study options outside the state, that they could lose out due to the results not coming out till September.
Well, again, I just want to acknowledge that last year, you know, an engagement has begun. Last year, we engaged with all of the providers in different jurisdictions, and very pleased that was a successful engagement. Indeed, I wrote to each of my European counterparts in that respect, and in the process of doing likewise. And we've already begun our engagements with these providers from abroad. And as I say, you know, it worked out very well last year, and I have no doubt that it will also work out very well this year.
Well, the UL and NUI Galway, they were due to start their academic year on the 6th of September. Have you been speaking with them, for example, whatever about other third level institutions? Are they going to push back the start of the academic year for first years?
Yes, indeed, there has been engagement with the third level institutes, the colleges, universities, and that. And I want to acknowledge, to their credit, they also accept that we are in the midst of a pandemic. I think they're also very conscious that we have achieved something that is almost unique in offering, as I said, the two processes. There will be a matter of days having to perhaps change start dates. But I think, you know, throughout this pandemic, we have learned that all of society does what's necessary to ensure that we can all make our way successfully through the pandemic. And I have no doubt that the third level institutions will do likewise this year. They did it last year, and I know that they will do all that they can to accommodate students. At the end of the day, we serve the students in the education sector, whether that's at you know, primary or secondary level or a third level, or indeed, you know, those that are going on to apprenticeships or whatever. You know, at every level, our focus is to ensure that students we get every possible best opportunity for themselves. And I'm very conscious that today, as we speak, it's the day before many of them are taking the written exam. So I want to assure them, we are all with them to ensure that they will achieve the very best of their ability.
Yeah. When I hear you talk there about the, you know, no backup paper and the extraordinary year that we're in and the late date for the results, I'm just wondering, is the State Examination Commission, are they under pressure? Are they under-resourced?
No, not at all. And you know, I suppose really just in reference to the late date for the exams, just to put it in context, it is earlier than last year. It is not a traditional exam situation. It is
neither was last year, in all fairness.
Pardon?
Neither was last year, of course.
No, and that's my point. So it is earlier, you know, it is earlier than last year. Neither last year nor this year were in any way traditional, I suppose, given that both achievements of offering leaving certificate or calculated grades or accredited grades as there are this year, plus the written exams, you know, is very different to what we would normally do. But we're talking about a matter of days here, where the days, the SEC are telling us, are required to ensure that, you know, best practice and oversight can be seen from their point of view. And I have every confidence that they are fully equipped to do it. And, you know, I have every confidence that they will deliver, as they've said.
All right, Minister, just before we move on from the exams tomorrow, this idea of the twin track approach, the accreditation or the choice that students will have, is this going to remain in place for the foreseeable future, do you think?
Well, as people would be aware, we are in the process of a senior cycle review where we are looking at all aspects of senior cycle. That's everything from transition year to LCVP, Leaving Certificate Applied, and the established Leaving Cert, as we will call it. So all aspects are being looked at, and there's an enormous public consultation involved in that. And, you know, we will look at all aspects of it. But I do want to be very clear. There are learnings, most definitely, from what has been achieved during this pandemic. But to be fair, the accredited grades process or the calculated grades process was very much an introduction because of the pandemic.
Yeah.
There is no prerequisites that would continue into the future. But I will say, as I say, we're looking at all aspects to ensure that whatever pathway students would choose to follow into the future, that the senior cycle is meeting the requirements for students to facilitate them pursuing those pathways.
Minister for Education Norma Foley talking to Damien O'Reilly. If you're single and out of the loop when it comes to dating, then this might be for you. Love After Lockdown is a free event organised by soulmate coach Jean Sullivan-Bellecci. And she chatted to Oliver Callan on The Ryan Tubridy Show this morning.
Good morning. So nice to talk to you again.
Brilliant. And you're down in Cork from what I remember, aren't you?
Absolutely.
Okay, so now that restrictions are lifting, you're hoping that to help people find love, not just online and all the dreaded apps and so on, but face-to-face and in-person.
Absolutely. You know, many singletons put their love lives on hold during lockdown, but now that things are opening up, you know, they're really eager to find a soulmate, but they've been in lockdown so long, many are very anxious and they lack confidence.
Okay, so what typically your clients that you're meeting, what are they, where are they in the world at the moment as we emerge out of lockdown?
They're still kind of recovering from, you know, being so isolated for so long. They're very eager to find love, but they're just really out of practice. And many, to be honest, have been binging on romantic comedies, you know, which kind of create an unrealistic picture, high expectations. They've been binging on crisps and, frankly, dating their sweatpants. So we need to help them climb out of their comfort
zone.
These
people need help. Okay, they need to partner up. Is there a huge difference, I presume there is, in your clients before COVID and we won't say post-COVID, but in the moment we're in right now?
So, you know, I think that, yes, I am seeing confidence plummeting even more. I think a lot of it is because they're out of practice. I think they've kind of lost some of their social skills, not lost, but just are out of practice.
Yeah.
And so my job is to help them by organizing this event and inviting a style coach and a nutrition and fitness coach just to kind of help them, you know, boost their confidence in a variety of ways. For me, helping them be confident is learning from their past mistakes, really owning their needs and their deal breakers, and being confident to kind of fly your freak flag so your fellow soulmates can recognize you as a kindred spirit.
Can you explain that, flying your freak flag?
It means being 100% authentic, not hiding any aspects of yourself. We're kind of taught to, you know, really play it safe and only give people just enough information. But I find that if you tell them, you know, exactly who you are, what you're into, even if you feel like it's odd, that is the best way to be most magnetic to the people who really appreciate that.
So how do you motivate someone who is dating their sweatpants, they're doing the Bridget Jones, they're eating a tub of ice cream, watching romantic comedy after? How do you get them up and at it?
Well, that's part of what this event is about. And also, I'm using some of the top tips from my book, Be the Soulmate You Want to Attract, mm-hmm. to help people really, you know, understand what the facts are, that they have a wonderful chance, to meet somebody. You know, sometimes we feel like it's because we're too much, we're too old, we're too heavy, we're too this or too that, too loud. But it's not really about that. It's really just about being brave enough to put yourself out there. So we go through a lot of tips about that. And then the style coach, Sharon Huggard, she's going to help people break up with those sweatpants so they don't fade into the background like a wallflower. And it's not about labels. It's just letting your true color shine so that you're more magnetic.
I presume there's loads of fish available in the sea, because we'd heard that the separations had sped up. There was a huge amount of breakups and so on, didn't we, during lockdown?
Yes, I think it became much more obvious, at least I've seen in my clients, when things weren't right. There weren't as many distractions of daily life. Mm-hmm. And people started to realize, you know, I'm not happy. Yeah. And so that part of what I believe in my heart is the key to attracting the right partner for you is being honest about, you know, who you are, what your deal breakers are. A lot of people have trouble owning those. They're so eager to find someone. They kind of relax their standards about what makes them happy. And I think that became really clear during lockdown.
Who is generally interested in love after lockdown? I mean, are most of your clients women?
Actually, I get about 60% women and about 40% men.
Right.
And I get all different sexualities as well. But I find, you know, part of the thing that everybody has in common also is they lack confidence because they don't feel comfortable in their bodies. It's not about looking great for someone else, but they just don't feel, you know, healthy and fit in their own skin. They don't feel good.
No, we didn't. We didn't. We're not blaming other people. There was some of us as well. Okay, so it's called Love After Lockdown. What are the details?
So the event takes place on July 6th.
Yes.
And it's at 7 p.m. our time here in Ireland. Mm-hmm. And all they need to do is go to my website, mysoulmatecoach.com.
Mysoulmatecoach.com, and it's on
Correct.
July 6th. So book your place there. Love after lockdown, boost your dating confidence and attract your partner, and divorce the sweatpants.
Exactly. Okay.
Soulmate coach Jean Sullivan Bellecci chatting to Oliver Callan. With many questions and concerns around pregnancy, fertility, COVID and the vaccine, Damien O'Reilly had guests Dr. Yvonne Williams, a GP in Shannon Medical Centre, and Christine Losher, Professor of Immunology at DCU, to discuss the issues and answer questions.
Now, we know that, if I can go to you first, Christine, here with me, we know that pregnant women are being prioritised for the vaccine rollout, but recent reports have suggested that in some of our maternity hospitals, only one in five pregnant women offered the vaccine are actually taking it. Is that understandable that pregnant women are a bit concerned?
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, absolutely. I'm not surprised by that number. Having been pregnant last year during the pandemic and the concerns, I completely understand the concerns of pregnant women. I think one of the most important things we need to do for those women is to give them the information that they're looking for. So I think one of the important things I want to do this morning was to kind of bring them up to speed with the latest information that we have from the research that shows that this vaccine is safe in pregnancy. And vaccines per se are safe in pregnancies. There's only a very small number of vaccines that you can't give a pregnant woman. And that's because they're a particular type of vaccine, and that doesn't apply to the COVID-19 vaccine.
So it is understandable that they would be concerned, obviously. They want to protect themselves and their baby. But there are, as you said, some international studies now showing effects, if any at all.
Yeah, and I think one of the most important things is there's a V-Safe program from the US, which now has over 120,000 women have been monitored after the vaccination in pregnancy. They took 35,000 of those and did a really in-depth analysis. And they just published that study in the last month. Mm. And that study showed that there was no differences in any of the outcomes at any stages of pregnancy. So I think that's really important to note. And I think the other thing to say, that's 35,000 women that were given that vaccine when they were pregnant. That's about the same number of people that were in the entire clinical trial for the Pfizer vaccine. So the numbers are large. We have 120,000 women vaccinated in the States now with Pfizer, and there are no adverse issues being reported. And that's real live world data.
And Yvonne, are you coming across this in your practice down there?
I think maybe we've been a little bit higher in terms of our uptake rate. We have one just one pregnant woman who's declined the vaccine, and one lady who is reading over the information that we would have spoken to last week. And in that particular case, she had been in the maternity hospital at 12 weeks and hadn't really had the option of getting the vaccine at that stage, didn't have a lot of information and isn't due back to the maternity hospital or wouldn't have been due back to us for quite a few more weeks to come. So she was in that category, I suppose, that, you know, there was a gap in the information going out to her. I think things are improving. A lot of the maternity hospitals have now set up a phone number for pregnant women to ring, and vaccination, I think, for pregnant women is speeding up. But we do know that, like, pregnant women, if you do get COVID, you're not more likely to catch it. But if you're unlucky enough to catch COVID, you're much more likely to end up in ICU and to end up ventilated, and unfortunately at a much higher risk of having a premature baby or getting an infection in the placenta. And I think the reason most women who are pregnant hesitate is they're afraid of causing harm to the baby. And it's an individual decision, but for a lot of women, it's much more risky to be exposed to COVID, particularly if you're living in an area such as, say, Limerick at the moment, where the rates are quite high.
Yeah. And just on that, why are pregnant women more at risk to serious illness if they contract COVID? And what are the risks to the baby?
So the risks to the baby are, I suppose, of having the mother having to have an emergency cesarean section, and being a premature baby can leave you with lifelong problems. There are risks, particularly not so much in the first wave we had of COVID, but the later waves we found in Ireland and the UK, there was a higher risk of late miscarriage, and unfortunately some really tragic cases of stillbirth and some very near misses as reported in the Rotunda. So the placenta can get infected with the COVID virus, and that causes massive problems for the baby then.
Yeah, Christine, you were both with us, so you're talking to Claire here recently to discuss this topic. But since then, the Irish Mail on Sunday, 2 days ago, reported HSE figures of a 36% uptake of all pregnant women who've had the chance to take the vaccine now. So going back to that initial question, is that concerning?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's concerning if women are having a low uptake because they don't feel they have enough information. So I think that would be my cause for concern. I think one of the, you know, interestingly, there was a lot of follow up actually to me, both through Twitter and actually email, women contacting me after I was on Claire Byrne the last time, asking things like, does the vaccine damage the baby? How does the vaccine work? Does it get near the baby? So I think one of the important things to say this morning to women is, the reason why people get a sore arm after a vaccine is because it's a local immune reaction. So this Pfizer vaccine is packaged in these little tiny, what we call nanoparticles, and they're like chocolate for your cells. So when you get that vaccine in there in your arm, the immune cells that are resident in the muscle are already waiting to take up those little particles. They take the messenger RNA straight into the cells and they get to work. It doesn't go widely into the bloodstream. It's not going to cross the placenta. There's a huge body of work on nanoparticles not being able to cross the placenta at certain sizes. So that messenger RNA is used, the instructions are used, it's broken down. It doesn't go into your nucleus, it doesn't go into your DNA, and it doesn't cross the placenta into the baby. And I think...
But it's a totally disproportionate figure compared to the rest of the population and the uptake. Yeah. So are pregnant women reading or being fed information that is very scary and frightening?
Well, I think there's two things. Number one is that when you are pregnant, you're literally in mama bear mode. You're in the most protective mode ever when it comes to protecting your baby. So if you ask a pregnant woman if she has a headache, does she want to take a paracetamol? A lot of them will say, oh no, I'll just go into a dark room and I'll take some water. So we're dealing with people who have a heightened concern because of the level of protection that they want to provide for their baby. And that's completely understandable. And the only thing that I think that we can provide for those women is the reassurance with the large numbers of women in the US. And we're seeing really like good figures and good data on safety of this vaccine. And also to be able to tell them the recent information, which is that while you're not at an increased risk of getting COVID, if you do get it, there are more consequences for the baby and for you during pregnancy than ever would be if you got the vaccine. And having been pregnant last year, I would have taken the hand off you for a vaccine. because of the concern of, yeah. of worrying about getting the infection.
Okay, and just on that, Yvonne, for people, for whatever reason, that are still remain convinced that they don't want to take the vaccine, what is your advice to, you know, pregnant women that are patients of yours down there in Shannon who say, no, I'm not going to take the vaccine. So what's plan B for them?
Well, firstly, I suppose it's up to each individual woman, but there are two very good guides that women can go on to. So the rcpi.ie website has a lovely visual aid and a PDF that women can download on their phone or on their computer and have a look at. And the WHO have a science in 5 minutes video that you can play with an expert talking through the COVID vaccine in pregnancy and breastfeeding and relating to fertility. So they're two easy things that can either be played or read for women. You can talk to your GP, your midwife, your obstetrician. It is an individual woman's decision, but I do think a lot of pregnant women sometimes underestimate their risk. So in Ireland, we know that we're generally quite old having our babies. So women over 35 are at an increased risk of more severe COVID. A woman with a BMI over 30 would also be at an increased risk. And then obviously as you get into the third trimester after 28 weeks, it's more risky for you if you catch COVID. So I do think women who are deciding whether to get the vaccine or not to get it should have a look at those resources, talk to a healthcare professional and calculate their own risk. There is a COVID age calculator where you can put in your risk. If you have conditions like asthma, diabetes, high blood pressure, you have a higher risk than perhaps somebody else. Women who are not white, who are from a black or an Asian ethnic mm-hmm. minority group, or living in an overcrowded area, or healthcare workers, women working in healthcare or in busy retail might be at an increased risk because of the amount of exposure they will have to people over the coming months.
Now, if the vaccine is safe, Yvonne, why is it only recommended for pregnant women between 14 and 36 weeks?
Well, I suppose, unfortunately, we know maybe one in four miscarriages or early pregnancies would end in miscarriage. And we don't want any sort of, I suppose, false social media myths getting out there that I had a miscarriage, I had my vaccine 2 weeks ago. So in general terms, like with the flu vaccine and the whooping cough vaccine, we don't give them in early pregnancy. We wait generally till women are 12 to 14 weeks. And that's to make sure that women have had their first scan and that everything looks OK so that there's no false connection between those two events happening. So after 14 weeks, you know, generally most pregnancies proceed quite well, and that's why we wait until the 14-week right. mark to give women that vaccine.
And Christine, why are pregnant women only being offered the mRNA vaccine?
So for two reasons. Number one is most women are pregnant are under the age of 50. So the we wouldn't at the moment our guidelines don't recommend Johnson & Johnson or AstraZeneca for people under 50. And then the other reason is that in terms of the information that we have on the safety of that, we have the most information on Pfizer. So as I said, those 120,000 women, we have the information on those already to say that is safe.
OK, I have a question here. I got my first dose of AstraZeneca in early February, now 16 weeks pregnant, and there's a 17 week gap between since my first jab. Should I take the second dose of AstraZeneca? Will it be effective or will I have lower protection? I'm 35 years old. That's from Anne. So I don't know who wants to take that, Yvonne.
Well, the guidelines at the moment do allow for a second dose of AstraZeneca in pregnancy if you've had the first dose. Obviously, 17 weeks is quite a gap. So depending on that woman's individual risk, where she's working and what she's doing, she may decide to go ahead with that second dose of AstraZeneca after talking to her midwife, obstetrician or GP.
OK, Christine, I want to talk about infertility. We know that there have been, as I said, going back to online and social media campaigns which have linked the COVID vaccine and women's infertility. Is this a false conclusion? And again, can you understand, particularly young women, maybe, you know, even teenagers or women in their early 20s who plan to have a family in later years, can you understand the reticence?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that I suppose happens in this group of individuals, and it's happening more, is that a lot of it's about where they get their information from.
Yeah.
And we do get a lot of information through our social media channels. And the social media channels, you know, I always kind of feel like if there's not enough good information out there, somebody will fill that gap with whatever information they'd like people to believe. And I think this is a really good example of what's happened here. So somebody basically said that when you make antibodies to the spike protein, which is what the vaccine actually makes your body do, those antibodies can recognise another protein which looks very similar, and that's found in the lining of the womb. And, you know, what I tried to say the last day was, in biological terms, there's practically zero similarity between those two proteins. So the spike protein doesn't look like this protein that's found in your yeah. womb, and actually looks as much like that as it does to any other protein that's found in your entire body.
So it's a real conflation conflation.
So it's a real conflation. It's a real kind of there's not an awful lot of information there. Let's fill that. And
yeah.
I think one of the things that we need to do is to make sure that people are informed about where the source of their information is. So this source came from an individual, was picked up by a number of other anti-vax group, and it was inflated. And, you know, I think there's a lot of hesitancy in younger people. I don't think they're anti-vax per se.
Yeah.
I think that they've been vaccinated, and I think they're open to that. I think they don't have enough information, and I think there needs to be a recognition that that they need the information that they would like. And I think what I wanted to do this morning was to say that there's absolutely no scientific basis or truth in the misinformation that's out there. If you look at the US, they had over 22 million recorded cases of COVID. And they realistically said that was probably three times higher, so about 70 million. There's been no impact on their fertility. There was people that got pregnant by accident during the Pfizer trial. More of them got pregnant by accident on the vaccine than on the placebo. So there are lots of other kind of anecdotal kind of evidence that there is no issue.
Well, very briefly, Yvonne, just final question to you. What do you say to some of your patients that will be younger women like that? Are they asking that question about its safety and possible effects on fertility?
We had a lot of questions on that, possibly going back a couple of months ago, less so, I think, in the last month or two, because I think that better, correct information is getting out there. But I know it was a cause of concern for healthcare workers, even, you know, when we were first being offered vaccinations. There was an issue with false reports on social media, but it does seem to be dying down now, thankfully.
That was Dr. Yvonne Williams, GP in Shannon Medical Centre, and Christine Losher, Professor of Immunology at DCU, speaking to Damien O'Reilly on Today. The Amazon founder Jeff Bezos said he'll fly to space with his brother on the first human flight launched by his company Blue Origin. Bezos is one of the world's richest men, and he said it's something he's always wanted to do. Space commentator Leo Enright gave his take to Rachel English on Morning Ireland.
Well, all of the billionaires, Rachel, and there are several of them involved in this business of space now, maintain that they have a grand vision of humans living and working in space routinely. And that's certainly been the dream of many space pioneers in the past. But the immediate opportunities here are for the very, very rich, I'm afraid.
Where will the Bezos brothers be going then, and how?
Well, they won't be going very far. They will simply be going up and down, rather like in a lift in a building. Only they'll be going to what they call the Van Karman line, 100 kilometres above the Earth. The whole flight will take just 10 minutes from start to finish. And the only requirement they have for the people flying in this spaceship, you don't have to be Superman or Superwoman. The only requirement is that you're able to climb 90 steps of stairs and not need to go to the bathroom for 90 minutes.
And on this 10-minute flight, I mean, what will they be able to see? What will they be able to do?
Well, I'll be honest with you, Rachel. I do think there's a special offer, as it were, with this Bezos spacecraft. It's not the only one, as we know. Richard Branson is flogging an entirely different system. But what is really unique about Blue Origin's offering is the size of the windows. Up to six people can sit inside this capsule, and the windows really are extraordinarily large. Much bigger than aircraft windows. We've seen they've flown more than a dozen times without people, and each one has been broadcast live by the company, in fairness to them. And the views really have been extraordinary through these huge panoramic windows.
You mentioned the fact that there are other billionaires who want to go to space. Is there a bit of one-upmanship here among billionaires?
Yeah, you do have to wonder, Rachel. Bezos made this announcement. He's under a lot of pressure. He set up this company way back in the year 2000, which seems like an awful long time ago now. And his mission, ultimately, is to make money out of this, but he hasn't made a cent yet. He hasn't successfully launched his bigger rocket, with which he hopes to get government contracts. And while all of this has been slowly progressing at Jeff Bezos's own pace, the other guy on the block, that is Elon Musk, the billionaire who invented PayPal, Elon Musk has already won huge NASA contracts to send men and women into space, to send cargo into space, and just now he's been given a contract to land humans back on the moon. So Bezos is in a hurry to catch up.
Space commentator Leo Enright on Morning Ireland. And also on the show, we heard about upset in Waterford City over the weekend when two pride flags were burned. Here's Mayor of Waterford, Councillor Damien Gagan.
Well, what happened was on Friday last, I erected two pride flags in Waterford City on the Mall, and I erected one flag in Dungarvan at our civic offices. And it's something I think was important that as mayor I would do that on Pride weekend. Pride of the Daisha festival was on over the weekend and it was quite successful. But late on Sunday night, two of the flags were removed from their flagpoles on the Mall in Waterford, and they were burned. They weren't just, you know, taken down and stolen. They were actually burned, and it was a deliberate act of hate, I believe, against the LGBT community. Yesterday morning, I was informed that it had happened overnight.
And is this being treated as a criminal matter by the Gardaí there?
It is indeed. It's in the hands of Gardaí now, and I'm confident that they'll get a positive result out of it. The Mall in Waterford City would be, covered by CCTV cameras, and I'm confident that we will see perpetrators facing a court in due course, and that's with the guards at the moment, so that's where that is. It's my intention, though, as mayor, to replace those two flags. I think it's important that I won't be deterred by what has happened, and I think it'll send out the right signal if I replace those flags. I think the people who carried out this act certainly aren't representative of the people of Waterford. Waterford is a very warm, inclusive place. And, people will always feel welcome in Waterford, no matter what your background or sexuality is. And I think it's important that that message goes out loud and clear.
Did this come as a shock to you? I'm wondering, was there any other evidence of any other types of homophobic attacks or assaults or verbal assaults of late?
No, absolutely not. It came totally out of the blue. I was totally surprised. The Pride of the Daisha festival and the flying of the flags in Waterford was very warmly received by members of the public right throughout the city and county. So for this act to occur on Sunday night, it certainly came as a bolt out of the blue. As I say, it certainly isn't, you know, representative of the people of Waterford. This is just, you know, a random act, really. But we can't let that type of behaviour take hold. And, you know, those pride flags will be back on the Mall again in Waterford.
There must be zero tolerance towards this sort of activity.
Absolutely not. That type of behaviour will not be tolerated. This is 2021. A point I made on social media over the weekend, sometimes people ask, you know, well, why is Pride celebrated? Well, there's your answer. Pride is celebrated because members of the community still come under attack on occasion. So it's important that we do show solidarity, and, you know, we do fly flags at Pride during the month of June. And it's my intention to really see those flags back on the Mall.
And are you confident you have the widespread support of people in the city right across the board for this?
Oh, absolutely. Last year, when I assumed the office of mayor in June, very first thing I did was I flew the pride flags in Waterford and in Dungarvan, and it was very successful. And I decided I'd do the same again this year, and I'd certainly be hopeful of that any mayor that would follow on would continue that tradition now. It does enjoy widespread support. I think people were absolutely delighted to see the flags there. I got phone calls and letters last year from people to say to me how proud they were to see the flags flying, and it certainly gave them a modicum of comfort to see the mayor making a very public statement by flying the flags on our prominent public buildings, both in the city and in the county in Dungarvan.
That was the Mayor of Waterford, Councillor Damien Gagan on Morning Ireland. Since the pandemic has kept us mainly confined to our homes, renovations are hugely popular at the moment, and architect Roisin Murphy from TV show Home Rescue chatted to Oliver Callan about her own experience and offered tips to listeners.
Good morning, Oliver.
Now, you're a tele-architect, so we assume your home is completely perfect.
Oh, yeah. I'm a particular type of tele-architect. Okay. I'm like the emergency repair kit. But yes, I am a tele-architect, I'm proud to say, I'm very proud of our programme, actually. We're people who work on very tight budgets in very tight turnaround times. So, unfortunately, it doesn't work so well on myself.
It's not like the grand designs, and therefore it's you do little miracles.
We do little miracles, yeah, we do.
So what was going on in your home then during the pandemic?
It wore out. I know this sounds mad, right? But it literally wore out. I couldn't believe it. The couch is like a saggy sponge thing. Now, it is a steel frame, so it's being held together like some mad kind of Tracy Emin sculpture. It's hideous.
Wow.
It's just the fabric is gone. All of the varnish is worn off the floors. The fridge, all the seals went. The windows kind of, it just wore out. I think the pandemic put houses under pressure
in a way.
It never happened. I've never
heard anyone wearing out a fridge before. But anyway, okay.
Think about all these teenagers in the house that are never usually in the house. They're in there and they're eating a lot, and they go to the fridge and then they come back to the fridge and they go to the fridge. There's nothing ever apparently in the fridge, but that doesn't stop them from opening it about 20 million times a day.
So I was going to ask, were you having house parties or something? But no, you just have teenagers. Tell us what's going on in your house.
It did literally wear out. And I think there's that thing where they went from everybody goes from being a younger child to an older child, and then they're young adults as well. I have now a 20-year-old.
Yeah.
So suddenly, and that thing that you refer to of not everybody being lucky enough to own a house, there was also that period where we all were able to get out of home and rent very cheaply. Years ago, you could get a bedsit. It was never cheap, but there was bedsits and stuff. That's gone. So there's... Your young adults are in your house, and I'm from the country as well, so it's new to me because I was out from home at 17. So they're at home and they're using the house in different ways, and they're bringing people and wanting to bring things like girlfriends back to the house. So it just changes it just changes the dynamic. They're no longer kind of playing football out the back. It just changes it up a bit.
Yeah, well, they're kind of adults, aren't they, living in among you?
Yeah, they are.
So you have two teenagers and a 20-year-old.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
So that's sufficient just to wear out the house.
I was getting away with murder because I used to put them out the garden when they were young. They'd go out the garden, and we had a big garden and trees and stuff. And there was a lane out the back, and there was parks and school. I think it's also the fact there's been no school or university. So they're at home. I think an awful lot of people have spoken about the couch in particular has come and been battered because we've never sat on couches in our homes as much. We've never used we're all working from home. It's just a different dynamic.
Yeah.
The house usually is not getting much of a break. And I think everybody has a little bit of money they would have spent. They've spurred away the COVID kind of savings. And suddenly we're all going, what am I going to do?
And so what condition was your kitchen in after the heavy bits of lockdown?
Well, apart from the heavy bits of lockdown, it was in tatters after lockdown, but then it went through this... I had a kind of very small pantry kitchen that I loved, and I still love, actually. But everybody has grown significantly, so people can't sit in the room anymore. And then as it was wearing out, I would get somebody in and I'd say, can you fix the window for me? This was even before lockdown. And they'd say, yeah, and they'd come in and have a look. I think a nosy... to see the woman off the telly's house. And then they were like, God almighty, there's no, they never came back. I'm not joking.
Really?
Really, two window repair guys. I was like, please come back. And I phone them and go, and they go, yeah, we'll sort you out. And then I realized that it was too tricky a job. It was a tiny little pantry kitchen and it was intricate enough work, So it was not, it was...
It's so much work they can kind of pick what they're doing.
Yeah, and they were not doing that.
I should say at this point, Rachel, since you are the fixer, if people are looking at their homes and they're feeling the same thing, that it's worn out and bet up, text us 51551. We put those questions to Roisin this morning. So a pantry kitchen, basically you don't eat your meals in a pantry kitchen. Is that the kind of definition of it?
I think it is. I think what is, I had an old Victorian house and traditionally the pantries were very small. Now, this would be across the board in all kinds of houses in Ireland. We had tiny little kitchens and hence the explosion of the extension. But what I did when I moved in was kind of, I had designed a kitchen that was kind of intense, like a little machine that did everything, washing machine, the whole lot. And it was very small. It was about 2.3 metres long. So I put that in. And we kind of adapted the table. I designed a little table that we could all sit on, a small table. So it was like a tiny cafe. And I'd gone to a restaurant years ago that you get from, that you get a boat out to. I don't know how to pronounce it. It's a place down the south, right? You get a boat out to this restaurant. And we had a meal in this restaurant. And the chef was working out of what looked like the size of a cupboard.
Right.
And he produced all this food. So I thought, you can do it. So that was the inspiration. But the problem was that as people have come, you know, the kids have grown and their friends are coming in, it's just not possible. But the pantry kitchen or this galley kitchen is also very trendy again. It's one of the most sought after images on Deval Kitchens, which would be a kind of a guru style kitchen designer. That's the one that's got the most likes on their social media.
It's the trend.
I think it's that they call it, I think, cottageology. It was done by Taylor Swift. It's this thing of kind of back to basics. The idea that, you know, the huge Monzo kitchens where you could nearly do open heart surgery in them. There's a move away from it, a kind of a shift.
Is there?
There is a shift. I think people, they've gotten, you know, I suppose maybe lockdown has affected people psychologically. But the idea of this kind of kitchen, a farmhouse kitchen, the minimalism is sort of on the wane in terms of, well, it's under pressure from people who are looking for a kind of, I suppose, a more sentimental home.
Yeah, it is a bit cold, isn't it? And unforgiving, those big showroom giant kitchens. And the island, of course, is the thing. Is that on the way out as well?
Well, it's on the way out for me. That doesn't mean it's on the way out for other people. I think I always wanted an island. And islands are really, really good in terms of when they're used cleverly for design. I would never put an island in just to have an island.
Right.
You know, they can be very good if you're in an apartment and you need an extra wall for some units. Like, you won't have the same structure as a house in terms of space. And they're very good if you have huge space because it gives form to it. But in medium-sized space like mine, the choice is table tennis or an island. And I was like, it was my daughter, so I was going, please don't put an island in. And it was the first time I'd ever really heard that, where they were like, oh God, not an island, as in, don't try and do the whole home show cooking thing with us. It's too late. But you know what I'm talking about, don't you?
Yeah, but does that mean that that the young adults are now, they have the input on how the house is shaped, and this is another offshoot, a terrible offshoot from lockdown?
But also, I did Google this in the end. I thought, are they, you know, because as you get older, you are required, unfortunately, to plug into the youth, because they will often be talking about stuff that I wouldn't, by the time it arrives into my mindset, it's gone. So they're very interesting in terms of trends, and everything they talk about is far more on, you know, we know that from Greta Thunberg and all of them, they're far more on the edge than we are.
Yes.
So when I heard this, I sort of Googled it and discovered that there's a whole load of people who are kind of going, the kitchen island hasn't really had its moment, because it sits there in the middle of the space. And if you have a small space, it really is difficult to integrate or argue for.
Because you need loads of space around it, don't you?
You need 1,200 millimetres for two people to pass.
That's a moat, basically. I suppose, because we're jaded, you see. We're jaded, whereas young people, you know, we're the bet-up house, and the young people, they're fresh to the world. So they've got all these notions.
And they're not thinking. Now, that said, the fellow who runs Prinks, or did before lockdown, the guy would have been, where the lads would have come back for, have you ever heard of Prinks, Oliver?
Prinks, it's familiar Prinks. At the edge of, no, don't know, Prinks?
Prinks are what you drink before the TY ball or the Deb.
Pre-drinks. Prinks.
That's it, pre-drinks. I never knew pre-drinks, right?
So we're like two elderly people discovering new young people words.
Young people and that Prinks.
But I was like, the fella who went through that period is kind of going, I wouldn't have minded a bit of, you know, he was kind of visualising himself with the cocktails and the beers lined up. But then they also, there are, during COVID, there were families who had table tennis tournaments and stuff like that. And I have a friend whose father's a builder. And we were discussing this island thing. And apparently when she was doing her kitchen, they were like, what? Island? No way. Absolute rubbish. Like it was, he was a country man and there was no way he was going to allow the daughter to put the island. But she was talking about, I visited her house, say, over the last 10 years. And her kids have had huge success sports-wise. And I argue it's because they didn't have an island. She would have put down the gym beam for doing cartwheels on for the daughter. She has little boogie boards that the nephews do pop-ups when they're learning how to surf. So I think there's a lot of opportunities lost in the kitchen if it's eaten up by an island.
Yes, and once it's in, you can't get the thing out
because
it's fixed. So what's happening at the moment? You're doing an extension, are you, to the house?
I'm doing a kitchen, basically a kitchen. And it is...
A kitchen extension?
I think an actual kitchen.
Because okay,
I try to incorporate the pantry and everything and say, we'll do this pantry kitchen and have this big room on it, which is again, and they were like, no, we're building an actual kitchen. So it'll have a run, which is what they call in the business, where you have the hob, the sink, the fridge, a run, and then it will have a table and a couch. Because apparently lots of people I've talked to about this, the phenomena of a kitchen is they all want to sit on the couch in the sun and eat. So
Where do you stand on utility rooms? Because I have a text in here from Kathleen. She says, I have a tiny utility and the washing machine and dryer are in there. There's no room for anything else. I have no storage, no shelves, no cupboards. Help.
Has she put one on top of the other? I know that sounds basic.
I can't tell from the text.
Yeah, because it's...
Washing machine and dryer. It could be all one.
Yeah, you could do an all one or you could put one on top of the other. The other ones are the hoist. You can do ones that come from the ceiling or retractable hanging lines that go up onto the ceiling.
Okay.
So they're very handy too. And overhead storage. So that's...
Just up high, get yourself a little step.
Yeah, up high. And then, but if you put one on top of the other, you can put a little wall beside it, or else incorporate, and this sounds very funky, say a sliding storage wall, you know, where you put the storage into the wall.
Okay, right. And yeah. It slides in.
Yeah, or the door becomes a little kind of mini shelf unit.
Very good. Someone else says, I'm in the exact same position with the wrecked house from lockdown as four kids, now teenagers, are on the brink, but I'm torn between doing the renovation or getting the hell out of it and squandering it all on a camper van. What do you think, Roisin?
I was there. Okay. I actually did that. And I even to the point that because we're on the road now at Home Rescue, we're down in Kilcock today. Uh-huh. And I did consider it. I thought I could easily do this, put the kids in the camper van and make them come and work for the summer. Because the problem is I'm now leaving the house with them. The wrecked house is now, the teenagers are still there, you know, kind of groggily making their way out of the beds in the morning. But yeah, I considered a camper van. Camper van.
So you were going full nomad land, Frances McDormand.
Yes.
Travelling around, okay.
Oh, why not? But they're actually apparently very difficult to get. They're not as simple.
Impossible,
not as easy to get. Yeah.
You probably get an old one that you can do up. Sure, that'd be easy for you.
Architect Roisin Murphy chatting to Oliver Callan, who was in for Ryan Tubridy this morning. Well, that's all we have time for on this edition of Playback Daily. We're back at the same time tomorrow. So from me, Louise Herity, thanks for listening and take care.